We just heard from former Justice Department lawyer John Yoo, who wrote a memo advising that the Geneva Conventions do not apply to al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters. It's one of the memos collected in the new book, The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib. My next guest, Kenneth Roth, is the executive director of Human Rights Watch. He says the Geneva Conventions should have covered the Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. Human Rights Watch released its annual report today, which is critical of the U.S.'s use of coercive interrogation techniques in the war on terrorism. What do you think the impact of the United States' use of coercive interrogation has been on other countries?
Well, it's had a twofold impact. Because the United States is not just any ordinary government, if an ordinary government commits torture or abuse, it's a violation of human rights, but it doesn't degrade the prohibition of torture. But the United States is so influential that when it engages in this kind of abusive interrogation, it ends up lowering the standard for everybody else. Then to make matters worse, traditionally the United States government has been one of the most important promoters of human rights. But today, when the U.S. tries to criticize other countries for their violations of human rights, for their acts of torture or abuse, they turn around and say, you've got to be kidding. You know, who are you to criticize us?
In your report, you cite some countries who have tried to justify their use of torture by referring to America's practices.
Yes, and in fact, I mean, I have to preface this by saying that the governments that tend to use this argument are highly abusive governments, so in no sense should their excuse be understood as a justification. But when you see governments like North Korea saying that it's absurd that the United States speak about human rights violations, or even Iran saying that, you know, the U.S. has no legitimacy in raising human rights concerns. We've encountered this in Malaysia, where they've justified, for example, their administrative detention by invoking Guantanamo, or Russia, where they cite Abu Ghraib to say that the abuses in Chechnya are really just the work of low-level soldiers. They couldn't possibly reflect policy judgments made in the Kremlin. These are, you know, transparent, cheap abuses, excuses, but they make it, in a sense, they make it easier for abusive governments around the world to deflect pressure from the United States that in the past had been an important tool to promote human rights, but these days are increasingly ineffective because this cheap response is now available to governments.
The Bush administration decided that the Geneva Conventions did not necessarily apply to the fighters from al-Qaeda and the Taliban, who were detained in Afghanistan and are now in prisons in Guantanamo. And the argument was that al-Qaeda doesn't represent a nation. They're just, you know, like freelance fighters or terrorists, so they should not come under the convention. And that the Taliban is a force from a failed state. And since it's a failed state, Afghanistan, and since it was a failed state at the time, then the Geneva Conventions don't need to apply to the Taliban either. And besides, the Taliban didn't do some of the things that you're supposed to do to qualify for the Geneva Conventions. They didn't wear uniforms. They didn't follow the international law. So would you agree with that analysis?
Well, everything that you've described is actually an argument for why al-Qaeda detainees or Taliban detainees should not be given the special privileges given to prisoners of war. But the Geneva Conventions are more than the protection of prisoners of war. Even if you're not a prisoner of war, so long as you're picked up on the battlefield in the case of an armed conflict between two parties to the Geneva Conventions, and there's no question that Afghanistan and the United States were both parties to the Geneva Conventions, in that case, everyone picked up on the battlefield, whether a combatant, a terrorist, an innocent civilian, you name it. They are all entitled to basic protection under the Geneva Conventions against torture and inhumane treatment. So in many respects, the whole POW argument is a bit of a red herring. Even if you grant the administration its claim that al-Qaeda or the Taliban are not entitled to prisoner of war status, nonetheless, the Geneva Conventions do protect them against torture and inhumane treatment.
I'd like to read you a paragraph from one of the more famous memos applying to this that was written by Alberto Gonzalez, who was the legal counsel to the president and is now the nominee for attorney general. And this is a memo from January 25th, 2002, to the president on the application of the Geneva Convention on Prisoners of War, the application to members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And here's the quote. As you have said, the war against terrorism is a new kind of war. It is not the traditional clash between nations adhering to the laws of war that form the backdrop for the Geneva Conventions. The nature of the new war places a high premium on other factors, such as the ability to quickly obtain information from captured terrorists and their sponsors in order to avoid further atrocities against American civilians, and the need to try terrorists for war crimes, such as wantonly killing civilians. In my judgment, this new paradigm renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions requiring that captured enemy be afforded such things as commissary privileges, advances of monthly pay, athletic uniforms, and scientific instruments. What's your interpretation of this paragraph?
Well, he's confusing a lot of different things. First of all, some of the more extraordinary privileges that he describes there are privileges for prisoners of war. And as I said, even if one accepts that Al-Qaeda or the Taliban are not prisoners of war, the Geneva Conventions nonetheless provide basic protections against torture and inhumane treatment. Now, he's simply wrong when he says that suggests the Geneva Conventions don't permit prosecution for war crimes. Even if you're a full-fledged prisoner of war, if you commit war crimes, they permit and, in fact, require you to be prosecuted. But I think at the bottom of this is the sense that, you know, for decades now, when other governments have faced serious security threats, when they faced war, when they faced the possibility of being overridden by an enemy, or when they faced serious terrorism, the United States has always upheld the Geneva Conventions because those impose limits on how governments can respond to an enemy, how they can deal with a security threat. But suddenly, when the United States faces a security threat, it rips up those rules. You know, somehow America's security threat is deemed unique. And I just don't accept that. Yes, it's a severe security threat, but others have faced comparable security threats and nonetheless respected the basic prohibition that one can never torture, one can never engage in inhumane treatment.
My guest is Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, which released its annual report today. There's a memo that was written by Assistant Attorney General Jay Bybee on the definition of torture. And this memo lays out what a recommended definition of torture. And I should say here, it was written by Jay Bybee, but apparently John Yoo had a lot to do with the writing of this. And let me read a paragraph from it. For the foregoing reasons, we conclude that torture covers only extreme acts. Severe pain is generally of the kind difficult for the victim to endure. Where the pain is physical, it must be of an intensity akin to that which accompanies serious physical injuries, such as death or organ failure. Severe mental pain requires suffering not just at the moment of infliction, but it also requires lasting psychological harm, such as seen in mental disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder. What do you think of that as a definition of torture?
Well, that definition is one of the most outrageous legal claims that the Bush administration has made. I mean, indeed, it's so outrageous that on the day of New Year's Eve, the Bush administration withdrew that definition because it didn't want Alberto Gonzalez, its nominee for attorney general, to have to face confirmation hearings where he would be required to defend that ridiculous definition. It's ridiculous because if the pain you have to suffer is the pain akin to organ failure, that would mean that, you know, classic kinds of torture, such as pulling out fingernails or even chopping off fingers, would not be torture because, of course, that's not the same as the failure of a basic bodily organ or something akin to death. It is a extremely narrow interpretation that was meant to legitimize a whole range of abusive treatments that, under any ordinary definition, would be torture because torture is properly defined, as even the Bush administration now agrees it should be defined, is any intentional infliction of severe pain and suffering, whether physical or mental.
This memo that we're describing, that was written by Jay Bybee, with a lot of input by John Yoo, discusses who has the authority to actually order torture or say that it is acceptable. Can you comment on that?
Well, yes. The memo makes the outrageous claim that the president has what it calls commander-in-chief authority to order torture. To claim that the president, simply by virtue of being commander-in-chief, can order torture would be as if we were to say that Saddam Hussein can commit genocide because he was commander-in-chief, or that Slobodan Milosevic can commit acts of ethnic cleansing because he was commander-in-chief. I mean, this would be a theory that would essentially jettison some of the most basic requirements of international law and would lead to us basically handing the keys to the jailhouse door to people like Milosevic or Saddam. So this is, you know, clearly something that does not stand up to legal scrutiny. Interestingly, although the Bush administration has withdrawn the extremely narrow definition of torture that was stated in the August 2002 memo, it has not withdrawn the claim about the president's so-called commander-in-chief authority. Instead, it has simply said it's unnecessary to address that question because the president, as a matter of policy, doesn't believe in torture. But of course, his policy predilections can change from day to day. The law should be persistent and unwavering. And the Bush administration has refused to say that as a matter of law, the president can never order torture.
What kind of investigation do you think needs to be conducted now into what happened at Abu Ghraib and what may be happening at Guantanamo Bay?
What is needed is a genuinely independent investigation. And so far, all that's happened is a series of self-investigations by the Pentagon. There has been no investigation looking at, for example, the role of White House officials, only one investigation by the Schlesinger Commission looking at the role of senior Pentagon officials, no independent investigation looking at the role of the CIA. And if one looks to the future, assuming that Alberto Gonzalez is going to be confirmed as the Attorney General, one will have one of the architects of U.S. interrogation policy in charge of any potential prosecution of civilian officials. There is little reason to believe that a criminal investigation of that sort will have the vigor and independence that's required to get to the bottom of the matter. So I believe that what's necessary now is the appointment of a special prosecutor. That is somebody who is charged with acting independently of the direction of the Attorney General. Special prosecutors have been appointed historically for far lesser crimes. Certainly the crime of torture and inhumane treatment is something that merits the appointment of this special kind of prosecutorial figure.
I'm sure you were following the confirmation hearings of Alberto Gonzalez, the president's nominee for attorney general. Are there any new interpretations of law pertaining to torture that came out of that?
There's one that frankly bowled me over. The president has been good recently about saying that he doesn't believe in torture, but he's been deliberately ignoring any statement about the parallel prohibition of what's known as cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. Now, historically, at the time when the U.S. Senate ratified the Torture Convention in the 1990s, they interpreted the phrase cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment to mean the same thing as the prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment in the U.S. Constitution. So, in essence, if you can't do it in the local jailhouse, you can't do it at Abu Ghraib. That's what we had always thought the Torture Convention meant. But this last week, Gonzalez, in his written testimony, said that, in fact, when they referred to the U.S. Constitution, they referred not only to the definition of inhumane treatment, but also to the geographic scope of the U.S. Constitution. And because the U.S. Constitution only applies within the U.S. territory or to Americans overseas, suddenly the Bush administration is claiming the right or the power to abuse people short of torture so long as they're an alien overseas. In essence, they're writing a blank check to the CIA to take non-Americans, to subcontract torture to jailhouses or detention facilities around the world, and to engage in highly abusive treatment just short of torture. Again, this is a radical claim. This is a claim that undermines one of the most basic prohibitions of international law. But this is a claim that was put in Gonzalez's confirmation papers. I hope, frankly, that the senators pick up on this and recognize how outrageous a claim it is. But this is just the latest indication that the abuse in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere is not just an aberration. It's not just the acts of a few bad apples at the bottom of the barrel, but that it indeed reflects policy decisions taken at the most senior levels of the Bush administration.
Kenneth Roth is the executive director of Human Rights Watch. Earlier, we heard from former Justice Department lawyer John Yoo and the editors of the new book, The Torture Papers.